from Mata Tang Sumun Yang. I'm Alan Hellowell, and this is Indotechno. Welcome to Season 5, Episode 5 of the Indotechno Podcast. Now that we've entered our fifth season, and with more than 125 episodes under our belt, we thought it might be interesting to invite back some of the entrepreneurs who joined us early on in the podcast to offer both a retrospective on what has transpired since our early conversations and an updated view of what the present and future hold in store. One entrepreneur that left such a deep impression with me personally, and moreover has gone on to thrive as one of Indonesia's most successful founders over the past decade, is Gibran Hutaifa, founder of eFishery, which is one of the country's leading quote-unquote aquatech or fish tech startups. Great to have you return to the show, Gibran.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me here again.
You're very welcome. Now, Gibran, if you don't mind, I'd love to toggle between updates on the business and then big picture questions such as personal development, leadership, and the nature of entrepreneurship in Indonesia. Are you game?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Now, I think the most fitting question for audiences that both know you and the company well, and those that are first timers, would be to describe what eFishery does today and how that has evolved since our first conversation in August of 2020.
So what eFishery does right now, we call ourselves a digital cooperative. So essentially, we're helping farmers on everything that they need, providing an end-to-end solution from an automatic feeding solution that helps them feed the fish automatically, and using the data to connect them with the feed distribution business, financing services, and also the offtake to sell to the B2B buyers. What's different compared to 2020? Essentially, the model is a bit similar. It's just that the scale that we are at is much different compared to when we were in 2020. But we're also now going a bit more downstream. We're selling to more downstream buyers. We started since this year selling to the export buyers and some of the retailers in the US. So I think the ecosystem has been getting big, but the model itself from providing end-to-end solution in aquaculture value chain has always been the same.
Understood. I love the term digital cooperative. Again, from those early days, it seems to imply a broadening of our value adds since those early days. And curious to find out about the company's innovations going downstream. But with this kind of broad response, can you tell me how the vision and mission of the company have evolved, if at all, since we last spoke?
The vision and the mission has always been the same. The idea of the company is that we want to provide values to the farmers and increase their productivity by creating a technology that is asset light enough to provide consolidation and aggregation of the small scale farmers in Indonesia. And we want to provide the technology that can be part of their daily basis and also increase their productivity and livelihood and use the data to build access to whatever it is, from the input to the financing to the output. So that's why since the very beginning, when we started, our mission was feed the fish with the world, because the idea is that the first technology that we built is to feed the fish, but we want to increase the productivity so the fish can connect to the consumers to feed the world. And that's essentially what has been transitioning over the past 10 years. The first 5 years is focusing on building the technology to help to feed the fish. But right now we want to focus on growing more productivity and connecting more consumers and disrupt the supply chain to be a bit more efficient so eventually we can feed the world. And also the feed the world part is interesting in the way that over the first 7-8 years, we only focus on Indonesia. And then in the 9th year, we started building our solution and the market to the US. And this year, we also started going regionally, starting from very local problems in a local scale, and then growing as national scale. And right now, we're aspiring to be a global company. That is the feed the world part.
Understood. I'm quite keen to come back to your internationalization efforts. But first, Gibran, what are the company's broad numbers now in terms of maybe fish farmers served as customers and any other metrics you'd like to cite?
Yeah, we have close to 200,000 farmers right now, almost all across Indonesia and 28 provinces. We're managing more than 400,000 pawns, which is our main metric of the unit economics. And since a few years ago, and probably from our first podcast, we've been the largest feed distributor in Indonesia. We're selling around 25,000 metric tons of feed on a monthly basis. We're also the largest fish and shrimp supplier in Indonesia. We're selling 18,000 metric tons of fish on a monthly basis. So I think that's generally it. And if we see on the scale of it, then we're now the largest and still the largest aquaculture technology company globally right now.
Wow, 200,000 farmers, 400,000 ponds across 28 provinces, and 25,000 metric tons of fish feed per month. That is absolutely a magnitude larger than when we last spoke. Now, the organization, if I'm not mistaken, has about 2,000 people and is clearly, from what you described, super operationally intense. What are the key lessons learned around people management with scaling the number of people so quickly?
Yeah, I think that's quite a big lesson learned for us because right now we're at 2,500 people. And I think one of the most interesting part of the growth that we've had is it happens during COVID when people are working from home. I think at the beginning of 2019, we were around 300, growing to 900, growing to 1,600, and right now we're 2,500. I think for one, we always believe that the framework that we use on building the organization, it needs to start from a strategy, and then we need to think about the structure, need to think about the process, and then think about the people. So when we hire people, we have to assure that it's part of the strategy, but we also know then how it helps financially, and then we have to put some controls on it. So that's why with an explosive growth that we have, we haven't been doing any mass layoff because we have to ensure that the growth of the cost will at least align and providing a bit more on the growth of our market. So that's our basic process. We also learned that the investments that we've built on the culture and the processes from 2017, 2018, we started doing our remote working policies even before COVID. So we had quite a strong process on the culture to be able to provide people with work from anywhere because we're a very distributed team. Essentially, we're in 28 provinces. We manage the farming on the ground. Back then, we had to be creative to get good talents because we couldn't compete with the big unicorns back then. So we had to be creative by building our own talent in the area of Yogyakarta and Malang. So I think that paid off the way that once COVID happened, then we already have a strong culture and processes to be able to work effectively, remotely, asynchronously. So that's why. And after the COVID happens, then we're also in a good position to be able to say to the talent market that, hey, we're working from anywhere. So once other companies starting to go back to the office, we don't have to, and then we can provide a unique value in the talent market to be able to provide it while also maintaining the productivity. So I think, yeah, the key levers on assuring that our growth in the team aligns with the strategy as well as building the culture that can be competitive and also the value that can be competitive to the market is crucial. While I think as a founder, I learned that having a strong direct report, the leadership team around you is crucial to growth of the team.
Fascinating. I can't say I hear much about the actual calculus behind growing headcount. Of the discipline of growth without waste that you talked about, thinking about incremental productivity, really from many of the entrepreneurs on the program, and it's refreshing for you to go into such detail. Now, Gibran, I remember our discussion of big data in our first episode. We, for instance, talked about the massive amount of data that is generated from both this process of automating fish husbandry and in assisting the farmer to buy feed and sell fish. Give us an updated appreciation of how you and eFishery are leveraging big data and maybe an example of its most powerful application.
Yeah, so the data is very core of eFishery. I think when you talk about eFishery, people are mistakenly seeing us as just an end-to-end platform. But it's not actually about the platform itself. What enables the platform was the data that captured by the IoT and the process is exactly what you said. So over the past 5 years, we have been figuring out and also developing ways and use cases on how to build the data and then build the value on top of the data, not just build some fancy analysis, but also creating processes and value chain surfaces for the farmers. A few things that is currently on the big scale is definitely using the data to aggregation and predict how many feed that the farmer's using, and we sell the feed. So it's still there. We're also using the data to build some sort of credit scoring. We work with the financial institution to provide pay later services to the farmers. That's still there. But I think what's different is that it continues to improve. Right now we have, for example, on the financing part, we disperse around 100 million a year, which is quite sizable for this type of sector. But it's a pure off balance sheet by working with the fintech company. So behind the data, then we created credit scoring to be able to tell even more accurately which farmers are good, which farmers are not. And then more impressively is that the data provide us with a good level of accuracy to show that our NPL is only 1.1%. So the data is one thing, but how the data have a use case to build credit scoring on fish farming with a good credit worthiness over the past 3 years in the big scale. So I think that's the challenge part for any type of the company. What we're excited about is right now on two new applications of the data. One is on the disease management, disease prediction. And we believe internally that it will be like a $1 billion problem that we're tapping into, because the shrimp and fish is also an all type of agriculture commodity are prone to disease. We're currently building the AI and any some analysis to be able to predict when disease will happen and then provide the right sets of prescription. So moving from the predictive analytics to prescriptive analytics, that's what I think we're very excited about, because it will unleash the whole productivity. And the second is bring the data to consumers. So this is what we haven't done before, because initially we provide the data revolve around farmers. But we realize once we do the export, what we can position uniquely in the market is that we do have the data compared to any other players that's selling shrimp and fish in the market. They don't have the data. When we sell our shrimp, it's not just about selling the shrimp or selling the fish, but it's also selling the story with the traceability of the data itself. So we can just show how the fish is farmed, whether it's using antibiotics or not, and the area around that, whether it's conserved or not. And then ultimately also showing who are the farmers, like who's the family behind the farmer. So when the consumers in the US, for example, they're buying in the retailer, then they can scan through the QR code and they're part of the whole story of the produce itself. So this is quite unique, because we do have the data from the farm up to gradually downstream since we've been building it, but to be able to create the data that also create value for both consumers and ultimately a better price for the farmers is something new to us, but we're as excited as before.
Some very cool examples of big data in action, as you just mentioned, for everything from credit scoring all the way to disease prediction. I would have never dawned on me that you could be using that fashion, but it makes sense. I want to take a sharp 180 degree turn right now with the following question. What has been your most disastrous decision over the past 3 to 5 years?
Interesting question. To be honest, over the past 5 years, we did not really make disastrous decision though, to be honest. We made mistakes in some of the decision, but I think the experimenting model that we built is to find a learning on that process. And the process that we built is to create, when we execute something, we always start early and start small, and then we validate it until we have enough conviction to then scale it up. If there was one biggest mistake of all was, I think we were too late on establishing the right system for HR to assure that we have a proper control and process. There was a hiccup when we were only 300 people and suddenly right now we have 2,500 people. Up to when we reached 2,000 people, we realized that the HR system that we use is the same HR system that we use still when we were 30 people. So you can imagine the mess internally and how then it creates a bad experience for both new employees and existing employees that we need to firefight all across. And myself, well, like the past year, I was the interim HR director myself. So really just focusing on getting done up until we hired the new chief of HR. But I think that would be our key, because we always focus on the business and the growth, but forgot on the back end core system of organization and HR. which then created issues. But I won't say that it's disastrous in a way. But if I need to go 5 years back, that will be one thing that I would change first.
Understood. Now, Gibran, it was also during our August 2020 interview that you first began discussing with me if eFisheries planned entrance into fintech. You've already referenced it a few times in our discussion today, but can you tell us more about how it's evolved, what's happened since? Has there been much diversification? Any other updates you'd like to share?
The idea of the fintech part, at least up until now, we want to focus on partnership and providing the data and then work with someone that actually doing it and have the capability to do it. So the fintech part of it for us is only the credit scoring part and created a system for the farmers to access that part. And then behind it, there's a technology and the API integration with all of the fintech companies. But we haven't been doing our own balance sheet loan to the farmers themselves. So I think that's important to note. However, I think the model is definitely, first, the size was different when we started, because when we started in August, we just started launching fintech in January 2020. So it was our first year. And in the first year, we're probably doing like a couple of million, 2-3 million a year of financing, of loan that we disperse for the farmers. But right now in 23, we're doing 100 million. So it has grown massively by 50 times over the past 3 years, which shows that it's definitely helped by the number of fintech partners that we're doing. Initially, it was only 2 fintech peer-to-peer lending companies that were willing to work with us. But right now we have around 16, not just fintech and peer-to-peer lending companies, but also the multi-finance banks, regional banks, and also national banks. It's interesting how usually the peer-to-peer lending was the one a bit more innovative and brave on the new type of financing, but we have been showing a good performance that de-risk the traditional financial institution to join and provide the loan for the farmers. And then we're branching out also to other type of product on the financing side. So the insurance is here now. Initially, the insurance wasn't there when the first we spoke. So we bundled the insurance with the credit right now and use our data to work with some of the insurance company, which was exciting when we started. And yeah, we also now branching out to multiple commodity. Back then it was only 2 commodities. Right now we're doing 7 type of commodities for the financing.
Gotcha. So we're basically talking about an ever-expanding jigsaw puzzle of financial services, such as insurance, one of the newest ones, through partnerships. And all of this is enabled at its core by our credit scoring capabilities. Now, Gibran, if you don't mind, you've talked about what surrounds the eFishery customer. Can you actually paint an updated picture of the model eFishery customer? What was he or she doing back in mid-2020? What were his or her numbers? And how have things changed for that fisherman in the intervening 3.5 years?
Yes, for the most part, I think at the beginning of 2020, the value chain services that we built was fairly limited. And then when we built any value chain services, we started doing the offline to assure that we provide services through our team. For example, in the mid-2020, typical fish farmers will use our automatic feeding solution and use the app to control it. But if they want to submit the loan and buy the feed, they will need to go to our field team or go to the eFishery Point, which is the small branch nearby the farming area. So they decide, I want to buy the feed, and then they go there and then the feed will be delivered. And I want to submit for the loan, and then they will submit the loan offline, providing some offline documentation as a part of the KYC. Same with if they're selling the fish. And the first is definitely back then the scale was much smaller. We only have a handful, well, probably 20 or even less than that, 10 eFishery Point with the small branches. Right now we have 200 eFishery Point. The offline point is more available. However, one thing that has been very fulfilling for us has been digitizing the whole transaction as well for the farmers. So right now the typical farmers, they're already using the auto feeder through the app, but if they want to buy the feed, they right now buy it through the app. If they want to submit the loan, they will use the app as well. If they want to sell the fish, they will send it through the app, and our harvest prediction data will automatically tell how much fish that they will be harvested. And then it will automatically connect to some sort of a digital contract for us to lock the harvest in a predictive price that we have. And then we list it out in our fresh marketplace. So we call it e-fresh, when the buyers purchase directly from the farmers. So this is interesting because 40% of the transaction right now has done online, which is quite significant numbers and quite significant growth compared to where we were in 2020. And 98% of the fish transaction from the B2B buyers is also done through the marketplace, through online. And it's a managed marketplace, as you can imagine, that is all connected to e-fishery. If we compare to 3 years ago, or if we compare to 10 years ago when we started, the changes is just so dramatic. Back then, farmers didn't even know how to use smartphones, so we had to educate them. But right now, we made progress.
That definitely seems to be the case. Very interesting to hear about this growing concentric circle of features and functionality that you offer your customers, because I find that a lot of tech-based solutions providers, they really have problems encouraging their target SME customers to adopt even the first solution. They just can't get the behavior going. They have to subsidize it or offer discounts. And the second those discounts get pulled, the behavior ends. And so it's very interesting to hear that incrementally you're succeeding in broadening their digital activities on the platform. And we've indeed spoken a lot on the show about a lack of digital literacy as being one of the biggest bottlenecks to tech adoption and modernization, from the Warung and SME space to the challenges of encouraging software as a service or SaaS. I frankly can't imagine digital literacy being any bigger a challenge than in fish farming. What are the dimensions of this challenge and how do you overcome it?
It has always been the biggest barrier for us. But the good thing about a fishery is we started from the most complex technology adoption possible for fish farming. What I mean by that is that when we started, we're not just selling the app. We're selling a mobile-based, cloud-based IoT solution for a fish farmer that never used any smartphone. So that we overcame the barrier to adopt through digitization by having to figure out how to provide that IoT solution. So the earliest thing that we did is that, first thing first, is that it's never about the technology. It's about how the value of the technology that can provide a clear benefit to them, a clear answer to them. That's exactly what you rightly said. If the technologies only provide convenience, then most of the small scale farmers and people in the bottom of the pyramid, they don't really care about the convenience. And for them, learning is inconvenient. So learning new things is inconvenient. So that's why you can't just move the behavior by telling them, hey, it's easy to buy from the app. And then you then suddenly incentivize them with discounts that is not sustaining because it's cheaper to them to the app. But if you can provide a clear benefit for them to change the behavior, for example, on the case of the IoT, first, when we did that, then we can provide, hey, we can reduce the feeding costs. We can double your margin. And suddenly it's an immediate benefit that they can realize without using technology compared to with using technology. It's a very clear benefit on their livelihood. That's the magnet for them to do that. That's one thing on the actual value proposition. And every value chain services that we build is never about the convenience. When we sell the seed to the farmers, we're able to tell by having the data that we have, hey, if you use this app, then you can get the cheaper feed. 70% of their cost is on the feed. And if it's cheaper feed, they have clear reasons to jump ship to using the app. Same with the loan as well. They didn't have any access to the formal loan. If they use eFishery, then they can have access on the formal loan. It will change that last year. So I think the core of the menu need to be strong enough on the, especially for the people in the bottom of the pyramid. So that's one. And the second is on the transitioning process for the farmers. So what we did, I think what people misinterpret about what eFishery has done, it's not about technology. Any good engineers can replicate our technology, right? But it's about how to get them to adopt. So at the very beginning, like the first 3 years of the company, I don't know whether I mentioned on the last podcast that we created this workshop or classes that we call Smartphone 101. So we had the classes, 20 farmers, 30 farmers gathered. We lend the smartphone and then we educate them about how to use the smartphone, not to use our app, not to use our technology, but how to use smartphone. How we created them Facebook accounts, YouTube accounts, and so how to use Facebook and YouTube. Because one thing that missing is that they didn't have a journey on the tech savviness like people in the city. They don't know, for example, that the burger bar, you know, three line icons is actually opening up settings. So that, as simple as that, is not natural for them. So we have to educate them on how to use a smartphone. So it's part of their daily basis. If in the daytime they're watching YouTube, then we're successful. And then we start introducing our app because our app was designed based on the common user experience. And that's what we're doing. We call it offline to online journey. So internally, it's all to offline to online journey in the sense that we attract them on the offline first, and then we educate them and onboard them to online. But you have to be there. So that's what we created. We're in a community driven with a 3-point that we have the small offices. It's not just like a branch. It's a community center, a tech education center for the farmers. And once you can provide it, then it's clear. The value is clear for them to stick. The behavior will change because you help them to change the behavior. But it's a bit of work because you have to put people on the ground. But once you build it, then it will be scalable enough.
Gotcha. So one, it's about explaining benefits, and two, being there physically, being the one who, as you described, introduces them to the basic smartphone and handholding them through their offline to online journey. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Gibran, changing tack, let's talk about the global markets. I believe that the global shrimp markets are close to all-time lows due to oversupply. Why, therefore, would we choose to go into exporting shrimp to the U.S. at this time?
When we decided to export shrimp to the U.S., the shrimp market was not as bad as what we were. So it was still okay. And then we had a good business case. That's why right now when we go to the U.S., we really manage our investments on that U.S. market. But I think to your point, right now it's an oversupply due to drivers. First is on the oversupply from Ecuador, mostly. They're increasing the supply and then driving down the price because they're pushing through inventory in the market right now. And the second is the lower consumption in the U.S. right now due to inflation and everything. So people eat seafood less than what they're used to. And some consumption was increased because of the incentives during COVID. So I think that changed. But the thing is that the market will change. Ecuador will manage down their own supply and production. And then the consumption will increase. Because right now the challenge is that if I go a bit more detail, the retailer doesn't want to reduce the shrimp price. Although the inventory price is going down right now, they maintain a higher price. So if you go to the retailer, the shrimp price is much higher than other type of protein, which impacts the consumption. So the consumption and the preference of the consumers don't really move per se, but the price is just too high compared to the other protein. So anyways, we believe that this will change. It will bounce back because people will continue to eat shrimp. The shrimp consumption will increase and the price will go down because the supply is going down either way. Which then, if that will change, what doesn't change is the fact that we're able to provide good cost leadership through better disease management. And we call it supply chain integration. So we're able to connect the closest processing facilities to the closest farmers in the certain sizes that is good for the export market. So we can provide that cost leadership and also good quality because we process it 4-6 hours after harvest so that we're selling on the premium end. And the second is that what doesn't change is that we're the only company, if that we're one of the few companies that can provide digital traceability up to the pond level to the consumers. So any players in Ecuador, in India, wouldn't be able to provide it. So I think if that the chain is, if it's unique to us, then we're able to give us the right to compete. Then whatever disruption and then fluctuation that happens in the market, it will be there. But if we have a core capability that's uniquely to us, we believe that we can still have the right to win. So I think that's the reason. But of course, the investments will wait and see how the market will change.
Understood. Now, Gibran, I wanted to return to something you touched upon briefly earlier in our chat. Tell us more about plans to roll out a direct-to-consumer brand.
The idea on the DTC consumer brand is that what I mentioned earlier on the good quality of shrimp, we're able to provide a good quality of shrimp from the farmers that is actually farming really good and provide a digital traceability. We want to have a price appreciation on that. and to be able to sell in premium. So they have to know that this is coming from e-fishery and this is coming from e-fishery farmers. Because once we add value to the consumer's level, then we can send back this value to the farmers and increase the farm gate price on the farmers. So I think that was the idea. And then having a DTC brand provide us with that capability. So we're not building our own distribution ourselves. We will work with the retailers and then having our own DTC brand so we can increase the value of the produce and commodity. But I think it's all about adding the value of the product, right? Initially, it was just selling light fish, selling live shrimp to wholesale traders, and we gradually a bit more downstream and adding value on top of it. And then we want to create value and then we want to share the value to the farmers. So I think that's the principles. But also, if we do have that story, and then the story is quite unique, especially from consumers in a certain market, it will also align up to the company story, let's say going towards the IPO. So as a farming-centric business, maybe most of the public investors, especially retail ones, they don't really know what's efficient, especially the foreign ones. Well, what's efficient? Well, is it fish farming? What's fish farming? Is it a good industry or not? But if we put DTC brand as part of the company story, assuming that we have a plant in this in the US, then it's also a more coherent story to tell, hey, we started in building this, and then we also delivering value to the consumers. And the third part is all about upside, right? We believe that consumption will increase, then we want to start experimenting whether we can impact consumption by educating the market right now, and then have an upside on that consumption growth and accelerate it even more quickly.
Let's return to potential IPO plans in a sec, but I want to go back to our international expansion. I've read that eFishery, and you also referenced this, the company plans to expand commercially into India in the first quarter of 2024. So many questions come to mind about this bold step. First, tell me about the genesis of this idea. How did it come about?
I think generally we always want to see ourselves as a regional / global company. So we have been experimenting and figuring out whether our model is replicable enough in the market. So we did pilot before India. We did pilot in Vietnam, Thailand, Bangladesh, and a few markets just to figure out the replicability and the product market fitness of eFishery in the other market. Because when we see on the 10, 20 years and aligning with our goal to feed the world, it can't just be helping Indonesian farmers. It needs to be having on a scale impacting the whole ecosystem of aquaculture. And why I mentioned those countries is that those are the top five, top six countries. China is the first, but China is complex for everyone. So we haven't touched China. Indonesia is the second. India is the third. And then Vietnam, Bangladesh, and so on. So that's why those countries is the key top target that we do have on building. So that was when the idea came. And then we started doing a pilot in a few countries in parallel by engaging some local partners. So yeah, focus on the key market and want to impact the region. It's also interesting and important to note that probably 80% of the aquaculture volume is produced in Asia, which is our core. So let's say if we're in the top 10 of countries in Asia, they will probably account for 70% of the total volume of aquaculture. Then that's when we're able to impact a global aquaculture value chain. That's the idea.
Understood. I was just thinking, we've actually seen a lot of Indian companies like Misho, Cardeco, Magic Pin, and I assume others, try and enter the Indonesian market and generally struggle. You are, to my awareness, the first Indonesian company going into India. In what areas do you think you'll uniquely enable success versus local competition?
First of all, the local competition isn't that much. It's quite unique. Like, India is definitely bigger in shrimp compared to Indonesia. 4 times the shrimp total market value if we compare to Indonesia. So that's why most of the aquaculture technology companies are focusing in shrimp only. So they provide technology for shrimp. When they have IoT, it's only for shrimp. Some people provide an off-take solution, but it's only for shrimp. So shrimp is very popular market for most of the companies, not just aquaculture technology companies, but also feed companies, the export companies, and everything. It's the prima donna in that. However, eFishery is uniquely started in fish. Shrimp is part of our business, but it's only 25% of our business right now. So So it has always been fish when we started, and right now the size is still in fish. And when we visited India, to our surprise, although the shrimp is definitely 4 times larger than Indonesia, their fish are significantly smaller. For example, the fish farmer's productivity in India is 20 times lower compared to Indonesian farmers per hectare production, which blows my mind. I thought that it's at least similar, but it's 20 times lower, which means that we simply replicate the way that we do farm in India and bundle with technology, and we can grow their bottom line, their productivity by 10, 20 times in a massive production. So I think that's when we started doing a pilot. We realized that we actually have something and a model that Indian local competition don't have, which is on fish. They're not touching fish. We do fish right now. That's why when we do a business, we've been in India in the past 12 months, is that 95% of our business is fish. And then we can provide a unique end-to-end solution. Fish farmers in India are much smaller scale farmers. That's what we love, working with the more fragmented small scale farmers, because once we impact them, they will become loyal for life. So I think that's where we are. So that's one. And then the second is that how our technology is quite replicable in our scale right now. Because when we talk about the IoT and competing with, let's say, with the IoT of Indian companies, then it's probably the same IoT. But with IoT embedded with the right feeding program from 400,000 points of data and 10 years worth of data, then nothing beats us. If we talk about credit scoring, no Indian aquaculture technology company provide credit scoring and financing to the farmers right now. Some did, but only in a small scale with a different model. But our credit scoring is still the credit scoring. Once we have a baseline of the data, we can replicate the credit scoring in the market right now. That's why when we start doing India, we only do IoT in the first 3 months, only IoT. But then we already are able to build an end-to-end management services since the second quarter, since our first year. Contrast to Indonesia, that we build the management services in our seventh year. And this is not due to the fact of the scale, but due to the fact of the scale that we borrow from Indonesia to be able to provide a technology that we can replicate even without the same amount of scale. And that scale, when nothing is close to the fishery if we talk about the scale.
Wow. So the opportunity to improve productivity alone seems massive, but there's also, as you mentioned, the lack of a robust credit scoring system. And that also sounds very exciting. Now, Gibran, a super big picture, maybe even philosophical question for you. We have what you might call entrepreneurial prototypes, the household names in the West: Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg. And most of us know what their most prominent characteristics are. Describe for us the unique traits of a successful Indonesian entrepreneur in your mind.
No, that's a hard question. I mean, typical Indonesian entrepreneurs that I have in mind, they're very local problems. So they started always from local problems and local context. And I'm not even talking about the new entrepreneurs coming from a tech perspective, which is most of the successful entrepreneurs, the likes of Gojek, Wikipedia, they started from very local problems and very unique problems that we have. But I'm talking about those, you know, big families in Indonesia, right? When they started, it's always started from small local problems and continually build trades, credibility, investments, and then now become a conglomerate. So I think that's important and very unique to Indonesia. And the other thing is that once we have the local market itself, the Indonesian ambition to capture as much market as possible is, I think, one thing that makes it unique from a local entrepreneur point of view. However, I would like to add, in my perspective, most of the entrepreneurs in Indonesia has been very successful. They've been creating a massive, impactful organization. But I think one thing that has been missing is that on that global context, where if you compare it to the likes of Steve Jobs, Elon, and successful entrepreneurs in the US, they always have that global mindset. They want to be the biggest in the world, right? And that's what I think has been missing from Indonesian entrepreneurs, because our market is big enough. They're happy they're impacting a local market. And also I want to add, maybe the next generation of entrepreneurs from Indonesia would be having that global mindset. So right now we only have a handful of companies that can be seen as a global leader coming from Indonesia. Very limited handful of category. by the next generation of entrepreneurs have that global mindset. They want to become a global leader in their own category. So I think that's what we want to have. And I think the last thing that I would like to do, maybe more than the others, is that I think the nationalism is also related to what makes Indonesian entrepreneurs successful. They want to help the country. They want to help the people. So eventually, even either starting from building the entrepreneurial and then creating a philanthropy organization, or in a few part from becoming a unicorn and then helping the government one way or another. So that level of purpose on helping foster the nation is something that is quite unique.
I appreciate your reference to that global mindset. But I think the important element in your answer to me is defining a local problem and then answering it with a local solution. Obviously, taking inspiration from peers globally when it's useful. But I find humbly that a common shortcoming amongst startups in Indonesia, it often involves introducing a foreign solution and then trying to find local problems that you hope your largely foreign solution might solve. And so I just find that some of the latest successes in the tech space in Indonesia, local problem, local entrepreneurs, local solutions, global best practice. And I wonder whether that chronology needs to be reexamined for a lot of companies that haven't succeeded like eFishery has. Now, I want to get back to brass tacks with a more conventional question. How do you think of an IPO timeline at this point, Gibran?
The timeline is depending on the market situation right now. We're just trying to figure out internally that we need to be IPO ready by 2025. So I think that's what our internal target, to be IPO ready. Actual targets for the IPO will be depending on the market situation and also which market that we're likely to IPO. So I think those two will also dictate the preparation pre-IPO, but internally, both on the financial position and also the story, the market, the new growth opportunities that we're currently doing, we want to be IPO ready on the internal perspective about 2025.
Understood. Gibran, I wanted to wrap up with, what aspect of eFishery are you proudest of?
Impact. It's always been the impact on the farmers. So every time that I visit farmers and see how their lives change, has always been my proudest moments. And there's countless encounters in the farmers that are very thankful because their lives change. And I think what's also interesting, as mentioned, I've been doing a pilot over the past 12 months in India. And then 3 weeks ago, we had this farmers gathering in one of the states. There was this farmer that drives 9 hours and bringing his big family to the event just simply because he knew that I was coming. And when he met me, he said he's very thankful on what eFishery is doing. He's changed his life and his family. Only in that span of 12 months that we've been doing a pilot. And in India, this is fairly new. We're not just replicating the technology. And this is what I mentioned internally, that, hey, it's easy to replicate the technology and the business model, but replicating the impact, the value, the purpose, that's what's special. So getting a product market fit is one thing, but getting a impact purpose fit is what's really important for us and what's driving myself internally and what has been the fulfilling journey of eFishery over the past 10 years.
Impact. It seems to explain it all. Gibran, great to get such a rich update on eFishery's path to growth and diversification, vertically, by product, service, geography, and otherwise, over the past 3.5 years. I can't believe it's been that long since we last spoke. I also deeply appreciate your honest self-reflection around the growing pains and expanding the organization to today's 2,500 in headcount, the HR and systems work that you ended up yourself having to roll up your sleeves and address personally. It's really been a privilege to have you come back onto the show, Gibran. What a tremendous story of growth and evolution. Thanks again for joining the podcast.
It's an honor for me to be here. Thanks, Levon.
You're very welcome. We hope our listeners have enjoyed today's podcast. As always, please consider sharing any feedback that you have about the Indotechno podcast with us. Terima kasih. Sampai jumpa lagi.